It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian, How Books Have Changed the Technology, is or soon will be available at the website, www.westchesterguardian.com. That's one word for Westchester Guardian. It is the 139th column in the Creative Disruption series. If the issue containing that column is not yet up, the previous issue containing my column, Automation Makes You Dumber, will be. I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if the need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And once again, John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Additionally, I've just begun a daily online newsletter. The website for it is on my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com. Check it out and subscribe. It's free and is only one email daily. To fund both the radio and the newspaper, both non-revenue producing time eaters, I've set up the GoFundMe site to try to ensure the ongoing sustainability of both. But as yet, the response has been underwhelming. I need to publicize it more, and the link is also on my website. Now, to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the on-air participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest the next week on this show will be dancer, former playmate, physical trainer, Divinity School graduate, attorney, and educator, Renee L. K. Estabrook. My guest tonight is the president and CEO of the financial services firm Jordan & Jordan. Perhaps not coincidentally, his name is Thomas Jordan. Prior to founding Jordan & Jordan in 1990, Tom was managing director or chairman of two major financial service firms and was involved in product development at IBM. I first met Tom about 30 years ago when he was chairman of the Mindcheck Weber, and I, both of my own consulting firm, McMullen, the McMullen Inc., and was the president of the New York City Computer User Groups. Tom came to a few of the user groups' investments special interest group meetings. Since then, we have had only occasional contact, even though we live in the same Westchester town. But when we were talking over the past weekend about our mutual Wall Street background, the names of people that we both knew well from our years on the street, George Davison, Dave Lowell, Norm Epstein, Mort Epstein, no relation, Fred Frohn, Charlie Shaw, Frank Stein, Dan McClum, Jim Canavino, Howard Rattel, Bill Toop, and many more just rolled off our lips. Tom and I got back in touch when he sent me that note about the mutual, the death of the mutual friend John O'Hara, and that eventually led to his being here tonight. It seems as though we have a lot to talk about, and we will tonight on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for inviting me.
Before going on with our stories, let's spend a minute on the late John O'Hara. He grew up in Inwood, my home nest. I didn't know him during his IBM years, although we had mutual friends, but came to know him through an internet mailing list that I had started throughout the old neighborhood. And then came to really appreciate his energy-winning personality and religious fervor when he was trying to put together the Catholic television network. You spoke movingly of him in the conversation with me after his death. Would you be able to describe John for the audience?
Sure. John was a I met John when I was at IBM, and I was in the data processing division, which was selling the big machines, and John was selling the smaller machines, the general assistance divisions. And John was just a better salesman than most of us because, you know, we didn't have to sell as aggressively because, frankly, you had to take these IBM mainframes. It's a question of when you take them. Whereas these guys were really, you know, really good salespeople, and you know, so I got to know John then, and then subsequent to that, we just kept in touch, and you know, in fact, his son, who works at Sun God now, has remained a friend of mine, and subsequent to that, John was with three or four companies, and whenever he'd come in to talk. It was always just a wonderful, belief that this was the solution that was going to solve, you know, whatever the problem might be. And he'd really believe it, and he was really successful at it. Interesting is that the last company he was with, they were acquired by IBM, and so he became an IBM employee, probably 20 years after he left IBM. And I said, do they keep the same employee number? Because those of us that worked at IBM, I don't know why, we remember our employee number. He said, yeah, I got my employee number back. But he was just a really wonderful guy, you know, would do anything for you. He was in the search business. He always tried to help people. I mean, if people, were in between jobs, you know, he'd be pointing out to them, you know, where they might be able to, get a job. So just a wonderful guy. It's funny, I sent a note to his wife and his son, he had five kids, on Thanksgiving Day because for the longest time I'd get a note from him on Thanksgiving Day. You know, now, John, you probably get a lot of them on Thanksgiving Day, but back then there weren't that many, and he just thought enough to send a note. So he's just a wonderful guy, Manhattan College graduate, in the service, you know, so just a great guy. I talked to him probably, a week before he passed on the phone, and it was just like an old conversation. And I said, well, you know, we'll get together in 2 weeks, and then he passed away the next weekend. But just a great guy, just a great man.
Yeah, he had been sick, and he probably knew that he was going. People that knew him from Rockland County and from New Jersey told me that. Okay, on to you. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
Jersey City, New Jersey. I grew up in downtown Jersey City. The place where everybody wants to live now. They're moving. They're moving there with the gentrification and stuff. And then in the seventh grade, moved uptown Jersey City, and part of it was to my father and mother, realized that if you were in St. Aloysius Parish, you only had to pay $11 a semester, where if you were outside the parish, you'd pay a lot of money, or whatever it was, a lot of money at the time. So we moved up there. So it was my grammar school, high school was in Jersey City, although we spent a lot of time in a place called Lake Walkill, which was in Sussex County, New Jersey. Back then, John, a lot of people, there were probably people there from Inwood, but a lot of people from the Bronx and Brooklyn, that was sort of like their weekend and their summer place away, They had a lot of public sector employees and stuff. So we spent a lot of time up in Sussex County also. So it was either Jersey City or Sussex County, New Jersey.
Was Frank Kenny the mayor of New Jersey then?
He was not then. John Kenny. John Kenny was not at the time. Actually, the mayor, it's funny you asked, the mayor actually was somebody who also had a house at Lake Walk Hill. Tom Whalen, was his name. And he was a good friend of my dad's. And we'd go to his house for Mass because his brother, who was a priest, and his sister was a nun, during the summer when he was on holiday, you know, he'd come up to visit, and we'd go over to his house for Mass, whenever they were around.
The reason I asked about Kenny is I remember him as being the little guy. Was that correct?
And that is correct.
And he was, when he was being indicted for something, one of the reporters, and the reporter that told me this story was a fellow named Alex Michelini, who was a very short guy for the Daily News. He and I were covering a hacker of trial in federal courthouse about, must be 35 years ago. And he was telling stories, and he said he's standing on the line as to bring Kenny into the courthouse, and he hears Kenny say to one of the sidekicks there, "Get that little son of a bitch out of the way." You know, of course they're about the same size. You know, Kenny's calling him. And then where'd you go to college? What did you study?
I went on to St. Peter's College in Jersey City, which was about 4 or 5 blocks from where I lived, right? You know, I was laughing about it and talking to my friends with the kind of work we go into, like my daughter was going to school, the work. I mean, I never remember even talking about it with my mother and father. The assumption was I was going to go to St. Peter's College, and so I studied. My major was mathematics, and my only obligation for my father was, besides getting good grades, of course, was the minor in education, because he said a teacher always has a job. So I was the only. There were 10 math majors in the class. I was the only one who had an education minor. So it was math major, education minor.
My wife Barbara was the math major, as was Ellen Hancock, who we were talking about before. How'd you happen to pick math?
I was always good in it. You know, it just it was always my best subject, and it just seemed like a logical thing to do. It was either that or or accounting. And you know, my father wanted to have the safety of being a teacher. It turns out it's really interesting. My senior year, I actually taught for 6 months. My senior year, St. Peter's Prep, which you probably heard of, John, is a Jesuit high school.
Right.
In Jersey, really good, excellent school. And one of their teachers had a heart condition and had to go out, and they needed a teacher on an emergency basis for a full semester. So they came to me and said, "Would you be willing to, teach?" And I said, "I'm still in college." And they said, "Yeah, but you can switch your day courses," and I only had 2 or 3 left to do, "to the nighttime, and you could teach in the daytime." And I said, "Sure." So I wound up teaching there. And it was just wonderful. I mean, it was just so much fun. I mean, I taught trigonometry and matrix algebra. The only problem was I hadn't had my course in matrix algebra yet, and these kids are really sharp. So trigonometry was easy, but matrix algebra, these kids would be asking me questions, right? Mr. Jordan, how about this? And I'd say, "Well, we're going to cover that tomorrow." And I go home at night and, look it up in the textbook, and so I could answer their question tomorrow. So, it was a wonderful experience.
That probably covered any student teaching requirement you would have had too for a license.
That's right. Yeah, and I had actually done that. I had already finished my student teaching at Dickinson High School in Jersey City, and I actually got I actually got paid to teach also. So it was a great experience. I really enjoyed teaching. While I was teaching, I thought about maybe I should do this. I was in ROTC at college, so I was going off to the service for 2 years. And so it wasn't like I was going to stay in teaching right then. But I thought about, do I really want to become a teacher, and, decided it probably, be a better alternative for me.
You mentioned the students being sharper and being ahead of you. I always regret it. I had a very nice brother in Oil Hollows for physics. He was actually a cousin of a friend of mine. He was a very nice person, but he didn't really know physics. He was teaching it because he was said to be teaching physics. And I had students in the class with me who knew more than he did. And I never really got into physics. And I wished when I grew up that I had a better foundation in both physics and in economics, because that's sort of thing to make the world go now, So.
Yeah, it's really weird how that can happen, right? Just bad luck that you, wind up getting someone that. I'm sure some of the parents of some of my students may have thought, like, oh, why are we getting this kid? It turns out I was really young when I was in college, right? So I was 20 years old, and some of these kids were 17 and 18, right? So they were probably just wondering. But I mean, in all humility, and I just noticed from talking to people, I'm a pretty good. I'm a pretty good teacher, and if I ever, I'm probably never going to retire, but if I ever did, I was associated right here in Yorktown, right, with the school system here. I was on the school board, and I really love, education, but, if you ever gave me a choice of, what I wanted to do later, it'd be working with high school kids, and probably, I'm not going to get a job as a principal, which would be fun. But, there's always a shortage of math teachers and physics teachers and some of the sciences. So I think, if I ever decide, I'd be able to get a job teaching math someplace.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I'm a college teacher, and I enjoy working with people who know why they're there and hopefully where they want to go, even though that things change so rapidly now that I have to keep beating them over the head with what you're learning now maybe out of date in 3 years, So, in your bio, you spoke glowingly of your service time. What were your duties, and where were you?
Yeah, I was with the Army Corps of Engineers, and my first assignment was basic training, which was in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And upon graduation, one of the captains came up to me and said, we actually have orders here for two places to go to, and you have a choice. We'll just give you a choice, but you got to tell me right now, do you want to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, or to Korea? And I had heard Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri was like, oh my gosh, not really all that interesting. So I said Korea, and it was a good choice because it was a great assignment. There was no war going on. But I got to be stationed up in the demilitarized zone, and and the engineers were building bridges, were building roads. I tell people I had a one of my guys runs a research consortium, and we had a dinner a couple of months ago, and he said everyone has to tell a little story about themselves that other people don't know about. So the story I told was that when I was in Korea, I probably had the most important job I've ever had, even up till today. And my job was to blow Freedom Bridge, which is one of the bridges. If the North Koreans were to attack, including today, the only way you could get across with all the equipment, you have to get across the Imjin River. And there's two bridges that to go across. And so my job was to blow one of those bridges. And yeah, it's pretty, and you couldn't blow them until you were about ready to be captured, right? Because the objective was to get all your troops back. We had some troops that were north of the river, and we had some tanks that were north of the river. So we had to get them all. We had to get them all back. But it was a pretty cool assignment. and I really enjoyed it. And then from there, I came back and went to Fort Raleigh, Kansas, and they were just actually loading up. That was the first in Korea. I was in the 1st Cavalry Division. In Kansas, it was the 1st Infantry Division, and this was the first big division that was going to Vietnam. And you know, they asked me if I wanted to go, and I didn't have to go because I just come back from Korea. And you know, I was naive enough to say, "What do you think I'd be doing?" They said, "We don't really know, but you might be burning down some of the forest." And I said, "Yeah, okay, that's all right. I won't bother going." But I was at a reunion a while ago with the guys that went, though. I stayed close to, well, most recently I've gotten in touch with some of these guys. So I went there and then went up to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin to open up some ranges for the National Guard for summer camp and stuff. So it was a great, experience. It really was.
I had one of those. I was in the reserves, and I was first in the National Guard, and I was with an Army Reserve unit over in the Bronx. And then that unit in the Bronx was transferred out to Fort Totten out by Rockaway. And we're out there, and they let us out early because I was supposed to get out in October, and instead they let us out at the end of August because they were going to be training in October and November up in Camp Drum, it's Fort Drum now, for winter training. And so they let us out, and we went home. And then that December, they activated the unit for Vietnam. So I was just I just got out of there early on time. And then you get out, then you got out, then how'd you wind up with IBM?
Yeah, and just one other story. When I got out in the service, I tell people that even though I was in Korea, I was never under combat. But then I stayed in the National Guard for 3 years, and I ran a company out in Teaneck, New Jersey, and we were called up for the riots in Newark, New Jersey. So that was probably the most dangerous assignment I ever had.
Wow.
We really weren't trained for it. You know, we go to Newark, New Jersey, and we had trained all our troops for breaking up crowds, right? We were ready, you know. And there weren't any crowds, right? People were just, you know, snipers from, you know, shooting from the windows. And, you know, we weren't all that cool on that. But everything, you know, we had to stay. Then we started working with the state police, and they were better trained than we were. So, but that was my.
So what caused that riot? I don't remember. What caused that riot?
Almost the same as Ferguson.
Okay.
You know, almost the same as Ferguson. You know, in this case here, it was policemen beating up a cab driver, and they went to the police station, and the police, you know, overreact a little bit, and then it just got out of control, and it wound up in 27, 28 people being killed. And you know, we went in there the second day, and it's the kind of things you remember. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, and I was the first unit down there, right? And I'm going through, and we're going to Garden State Parkway to get to Newark because we were in Teaneck, right? And some guy says we have to pay tolls. I said, "Are you kidding me? You know, we're not paying any tolls, right?" I said, "All these trucks behind you are coming through, right?" You know, it was. And then we got there, right? And then we had to figure out what we were going to do. But it turned out that, you know, as I said, you know, we wound up getting on, you know, putting on every corner. But it's not that much dissimilar to Ferguson.
Was Leroy Jones one of the prime protesters then, the fellow that's son is now in a council, well, the mayor there, he was the poet, the Baca Bomber, I guess?
Yeah, I don't remember. I know who he is, but I don't remember his name being associated with it.
Okay.
You know what, John, I don't think there was any big spokesman or anything at that point. You know, it was just something that was a little bit out of control and, the Newark Police Department was just, it was probably the same situation, white police department, black residents, type thing. And, You know, and it wasn't as disciplined as it should be. And, you know, once we came in, but then the state police mostly, the state police were just better trained than the local police. And then, you know, it settled down.
Then how did you then get to IBM?
After the service, I went to work for Allstate Insurance in Murray Hill, New Jersey. And it was pretty, you know, and I was a management trainee, you know, we do everything, right? You know, you sort mail, you know, with snow and you direct traffic and, you know, you do processing and stuff like that. And, you know, and it wasn't all that interesting, but I think the catalyst, though, that caused me to make a change, and I may have made it anyway, was that I came home one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and my mother and dad are sitting at the kitchen table. And I said, Mom, what are you doing here? She said, I'm nervous, right? You know, you're out till 2 o'clock. And I said, Mom, I was in Korea. And she said, it's different, right? It's different when you're home, right? And I think we all realize that now, you know. I mean, even, you know, no matter how old your kids are, if they're living at home, you worry about it. So that Sunday, I looked at the New York Times and said, oh, there's a job in Poughkeepsie. And I had to look at a map to see where it was. And I said, that's far enough away, because back then you couldn't tell your mom and dad that, oh, I'm just going to get my own apartment. Like, you know, they'd say, what's wrong, you know, with here? So that's how I wound up in Poughkeepsie. I wound up there. And, you know, and John, I got to tell you, if you were a math major or a physics major, you know, you were going to get hired, right? And so I wound up going up there and, you know, getting a job as a programmer, you know, for them. I mean, I remember when I got the job offer, they said, well, how much money do you want? And I told them what I want, and they came back and said, well, we can't pay you that. And I said, that's okay. They're going to send me to school for 6 months. I don't really care if they... And they said, we can't pay that low. We have to, so the minimum we have to pay is $7,200. So I said, okay, I'll take that.
Then how long were you up in Poughkeepsie?
I was there for 6 years. They had a return to the field movement. And, you know, it was really pretty good in Poughkeepsie. I mean, I almost left to go to, I was accepted into Columbia, and I almost left to go to get my MBA there. And then they made me a manager. And, I mean, the kind of training you get as an IBM manager is just phenomenal. Maybe today, but certainly back then. So I decided, well, I can, you know, get the experience here. So I became a manager and managed a whole bunch of programmers. But then I decided that I really wanted to go to the field. So I said, New York City sounds pretty cool. So I really wanted to go into public sector, because I was doing, work up there with working with the poor and disenfranchised and stuff. And so I figured, you know, that would be a good combination if I could do that for New York City. But the only jobs I had in public sector was with the fire department. And I said, that doesn't sound too cool. And so I wound up, getting an interview in the Wall Street branch, and that's how I wound up with, the start of my Wall Street career.
Now, you also got a master's. That union, though, were you in Poughkeepsie then when you got the master's? Or?
I did. I was and that was the other thing, right? I got a master's, and, you know, it was terrific. I mean, I only went to Union College Schenectady once for graduation. They actually held the classes on Vassar campus. So it was really, you know, pretty convenient. You know, you'd leave at 5 o'clock to go to these classes, and it was good. It was good. I think it only took 4 years to do, so it would work out well.
The deal that that IBM had with Marist, who they're extremely close to, the students going for their masters got 4 hours off a week to study. IBM paid for everything up front, whereas many, many corporations paid only after you get past the course, and they did very well. We kept turning out the students. I wound up teaching during the IBM shakeup when they were cutting people. I was transferring people. We had students who were about to take the capstone course in information systems, and they would transfer to Burlington or to Austin, Texas, or to Raleigh. And then rather than have them just show up at the local school and say, do you have something like this that was supposed to be the capstone of all the courses they had taken, we put together an online course in on one of these text-based virtual reality platforms. And I came in every Sunday, or I did it from home, every Sunday from 11 to 2. And it was a terrific experience both for them and for me, because you mentioned minority neighborhoods. In early March, I asked one of the fellows, we'd start off early, how was your weekend? And he'd say, oh, I was out in the yard yesterday. It got very hot here, so I was working in the yard. And boy, am I brown. And the guy in Raleigh said, I'm always brown. It had never come up. And that's the first thing that you notice in the physical world. But it never come up who was white and who was black. It was it was very interesting. So yeah.
How long was the course?
The course was the full semester, and then they had to come to campus to deliver their presentations in the capstone course. And another funny thing was, two fellas in Austin whose field of study and their paper was fairly similar, and they were sending email back and forth to each other and sharing sources. But when they came to the campus in Poughkeepsie, it was the first time they had met. They didn't go out to lunch in Austin. They just talked by email. So that was also funny.
That's funny. You mentioned Raleigh. My first trip, in business was down to Raleigh, North Carolina. It's when I was in Poughkeepsie. And I'd become an expert in doing systems generations, which was getting the whole computer started. And they were having a problem in Raleigh. So they sent me down. So I get down there, and, around 5 o'clock, people start leaving. I go, where are you guys going? We're working all night here. We're going to get this thing fixed, right? And they said, you can work all night if you want to, Tom. Tonight's the Duke, North Carolina game, and we're going to the Duke, North Carolina game. I said, oh, okay.
Well, New York time is very different. When I was in San Francisco, and I went out there, as I said the other night, when Morgan Stanley acquired the West Coast firm. And it was that the whole attitude was, well, if it doesn't get done today, that's what tomorrow's for. I'm going, where's everybody going, And it was just a very different laid-back attitude. Now, I believe that's changed with all of the economic problems over the last 35 years since I was out there, but it was very, very, very different then. When you went into the Wall Street office, there was both the banking and the brokerage office, and there was also there were the SEs and the sales folks and the CEs, and what did you get involved with?
It's interesting. I went to the office, right, and I wanted to go into sales, right? And people, I had a technical background, right? And so the sales manager wanted me to become an SE, right? And he said, we're just installing TSO, and you really know that. So, why don't we put you in as an SE for 2 years, and we'll switch you over to sales? And I decided I wanted to go into sales. And I said, no, that's okay. I'll just go to another branch, right? And I started walking out of the office, right? And I'll never forget to this day, Jay Fuchs and comes running up to me, who was the SE manager. He said, the branch manager wants to speak to you, right? Who turns out he's like my best friend now, Bernie Curran, on it. And I told him, he said, all right, you want to go to sales? And I did. And so I started in sales. Now, it turns out, I had been a manager in Poughkeepsie, as I said, and there came to be an opening on the SE manager side, and they can move me into management faster then. So then I became an SE manager, after a couple of other assignments, and then wind up going back to sales. But I started with in sales, and you're brand new, right? So they give you the small accounts, and we talked the other night, and my partner George Bell had Reynolds Securities, so I started hanging around with him a little bit. He had A.G. Becker, so I hung around with him. My only account was a company that you probably never heard of, Clark Dodge. You ever hear of Clark Dodge?
Sure, I did. Jack Kelly was the data processing manager.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And Lou Groweman and stuff. And so that was my account. So that was my initiation into Wall Street. And it was a good initiation because you can just, you know, you can just learn a lot at these smaller companies than you can at the big ones.
Kelly went to Bitsy after that. They went away. We also had Peter DuPont after DuPont went away. So you had these people that were all part of the original data management group, what EDP Association was called then. It was Flanagan, Epstein, Kelly, DuPont, and the guy from Wolfson, whose name escapes me. Oh, by the way, the fellow I was trying to remember in our earlier conversation, the sales guy, was Bill Carey.
Oh, my God. I know Bill very well. Bill is alive. We had a reunion you've been to Harry's at Hanover Square?
Yes, I have.
We used to go there every Thursday night. But anyway, we had a reunion there about 4 months ago now, and
I thought Harry's was gone.
It closed and it's open again.
Oh, it is, and is it still Harry?
It's still Harry.
Okay.
It's still Harry, same guy. So we had a reunion there, and we had like 35 people that worked for IBM in the 70s and the 80s. And some of the guys on the Merrill Lynch account, which with Bill Carey was on at the end, got in touch with Bill Carey. And Bill, he's not feeling, he didn't feel well enough to travel, in other words, but just the nicest guy in the world and, you know, very effective salesperson on it. He's a great guy.
He was very close to my old boss at Dean Wood, Bob Flanagan, who also came out of Inwood years ahead of me. It's funny, I heard a Harry story just last weekend. There's a fellow also from Inwood who was multimillionaire in sales, big house, and drank his way out totally. He's been in AA for years, but he was one of the heavy hitters in Harry's. Then after about 10 years, Harry said, "Tonight's your last night here." He said, "What do you mean, Harry?" He said, "I've been your biggest bar guy." He said, "Yeah, that's the reason." He says, "You've gone over the top, and I won't serve you here anymore." And I thought that was very interesting. That he'll turn away one of his big spenders, you know.
Yeah, he's the classiest guy in the world. He's a really good friend. His son graduated from Georgetown, and he could get a job at any investment bank he wanted to because his father knows everybody, right? And senior year, he came up to his dad and he said, "You know what, Dad? You know what business I really like?" He said, "What?" He said, "I really like the business you're in." So he's in there with his, and now he has 25 restaurants. You know, the way this works, they all invest in certain things. But he has like 25 different restaurants now. And if you ever met him, he has the same mannerisms of his dad and the same, you know, quality of running a business. And except he's bringing young people in, you know. And,
I like
they have a bus that will, you know, take people from one pub to another, you know, on nice nights during the spring and summer.
We like the food very much then. As a matter of fact, I took the first time I met my wife, we were marketing. I was with Davidson then, and we were marketing to Beige. And that was an interesting thing because John Letson had he had a brochure that was prepared by Informatics, who had worked with us at Dean Witter in the system. Then Letson had waved it around earlier and pointed to this, and I didn't want to tell him, John, I wrote that, you know, for Dean Witter. But then they have three people from Beige, and they have Dan McClune and I and Paul Davidson, and we took the Beige people out after it, and that was when I first met my wife, and they didn't buy the product, but then she had to marry me anyhow, so she thought that was the deal.
Who was she with at the time?
She was at Beige, and she had been at. She also majored did math at Penn State, and then she went to work for AT&T, and then to New York Stock Exchange, and then to Bache, and then the fellow just before I, or a little while before I left Bitsy to go to Morgan Stanley, the program manager that Bitsy called me up, and he said, I have this resume from this Barbara Burke. Do you know her? And I said, yeah. So would you recommend her? I said, absolutely. And then I wound up going over there. We wound up getting married and forming our own firm after about 2.5 years at Morgan Stanley. And they were very good to us. They gave us all the I'm sitting at a desk now that used to belong to Bob Baldwin, who was the president of the firm. They gave us 7 desks, and they gave us all sorts of furniture and all sorts of stuff when we formed our own firm. File cabinets.
Was Bache in 100 Gold Street at that time?
Yeah, Bache was at 100 Gold, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Because yeah. I remember when I was I handled Bache at a while, and I was Hal Rich was probably after your time.
No, I knew the name.
In her name, the CIO. He was the CIO over there, right? And we had this great SE, right? And he was great with it if you got him on the account. But So anyway, they were having a problem with CICS, and I went over and I said, Hal, Frank's going to be here. He's going to be here. We solved the problem, right? And as I'm talking to him, I could see out the window because he was on the first floor, had a corner office. I could see Frank walking away from the building, and I'm just hoping. I hope he doesn't turn around.
It was interesting. You mentioned CICS. Bitsy went from a controlled, not Bitsy, Dean Witter went from a controlled data system to IBM, brokerage CCAP. CCAP, as you probably remember, had started up in the airlines. And when it came down to Wall Street, they couldn't understand that it had to be faster for executions than Wall Street, than it had to be flying planes. And then IBM worked with us, and they turned CCAP into BCCAP. Gib Hoxie was one of the IBM guys. I don't know if you remember Gib.
Who was it?
Gib Hoxie.
He later
became the president of a company that had a financial modeling program for the Apple II and for the initial IBM PC, but it ran under the UCSD operating system. And when IBM went totally DOS, that was about the end of the game for his product.
We replaced both at Dean Witter and at Bache. We put in the follow-on to BCCAP was something called TCAM.
Sure.
And we put that in, and then we IBM also had something called the Securities Automatch, and we had that at both companies also.
No, we had that there. Our order of manager was some named Frank Deedy, and he was in there when the automatch went in. One of the funny things was that we first brought in the Model 30 to run to replace the 1401, and we had Model 30s and 25s out on the West Coast, and Informatics wrote a program on the BCAP to transmit a margin printouts because most of our accounts were on the West Coast at the time. So then when we were going to the system on the 50s, the Broch accounting system, Informatics came in and they had a proposal to redo it on the TCAM, the transmission, and at the bill of about $60,000. And then our communications manager found that HASP would support remote printers wherever they were at a cost of nothing, and we went on to HASP. so that was fun. And how long be with IBM?
16 years, actually. I stayed in the brokerage office. Went to for a while. I was on a regional staff where we, the way it works in IBM is you go staff line, And so for a while, a couple of years, my job was fighting Ambrils, you know, around the East Coast to try and stop Ambrils from going in.
Sure.
And then I came back to the securities industry in terms of being a marketing manager. And then I was ready to move back to actually to an Allmont position. And did you ever know Stu Munchak?
Only by name. I probably met him once or twice, but I really didn't know him.
Yeah, really personable guy. And I remember calling him when I was at IBM because, we were sort of controlling what was going on. But then every once in a while you'd hear this thing called Data General, right? And so I called him up and said, why do you keep recommending Data General? I mean, you know, IBM, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we got together and we got to know each other pretty well. And, you know, he explained to me that when you sell a Data General machine, you get 30% of the revenue, right? I mean, what kind of revenue do you share with us on the whole thing, you know? But we got to know each other really well. And then I got together with him once and said, I got to tell you, I'm moving to a new position. I'm leaving this. And by the way, by then we had worked a partnership out with IBM and Merrill Lynch and Munchak Weber to build a alternative to Quotron. Quotron had a quote system at the time. And
right.
So I said, well, you know, we got it going. I said, I'm ready to move up to... And he said, why do you want to do that? He said, why don't you stay here? He said, you're going to wind up back on Wall Street anyway, you know. And the guy was a pretty good sales guy, right? I mean, you know, he and his wife took my wife and I out. And anyway, so then I switched over to Munchak Weber at that point in time. So it was after 16 years. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. Because you mentioned Mort Epstein when we talked?
Yeah.
Right, because you knew Mort. And,
right. He was the sales manager. We had a couple of salespeople, and they almost sold themselves of the equipment that we had. And one fellow was Herman Lips, who lived up in Ossining, and Stan Gebler, and I have a story about Stan, and Data General, by the way, if you remember Stan. And then we had Then Carrie passed through, and we had a bunch of different sales folks.
Yeah, Herman Lips I knew, and we had a party for Herman Lips. Norm Epstein from E.F. Hutton told me Herman Lips called on E.F. Hutton when they didn't have any IBM equipment. They had RCA equipment, right? And Norm Epstein told me, he said, you know, you guys from IBM should be grateful to Herman Lips because all these years he dropped these manuals off. So I said, well, he's retiring. He said, well, invite me to the retirement. And we did. We had a retirement party for Herman, and Norm Epstein was there and gave a very nice speech on, you know, the importance of the relationship. You know, that's back when you had the relationships on the whole thing. But what made me think about Mort Epstein? Mort was in the next office for me at IBM, right? And I decided I was going to resign and go to Munchak Weber, right? And it's a Friday, and that afternoon I'm getting a pain in my left arm. And I said, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack, right? And, you know, back then it was like, you know, if you're going to be sick, you know, you want to be with IBM. You want to be with the IBM Corporation because, you know, they're going to take care of you. So I go into Mort, and I said, Mort, I'm going to tell you something I haven't told anyone. I was going to resign from my, and he had just come back from a triple bypass, right? So he's my expert on hearts. And I said, I'm going to resign today, but I'm having a, and he said, Tom, you're just nervous. You know, that's what it is. You know, you're fine. And he said, oh, I feel so happy for you. He said, I'd never leave IBM, but this is great for you, right? And sure enough, then I went in to see my boss and resigned. And then, you know, the pain went away. He was exactly right on that. He was just a level setting guy that, you know, was well respected. I mean, his account back then was the exchanges. He was handling, you know, the New York Stock Exchange, which was a pretty serious account, and, you know, just a real professional.
one of my closest friends from childhood, a fellow named Gene Schneider, was a director at IBM, and he was in Poughkeepsie, and then he was in Boca, and then Atlanta, and then he was in Danbury. When he was in Danbury, we were at his house, and he'd had just some medical thing done, and his wife said that that the funeral director had instructions that if he was to die any place, she was to put the briefcase in his hand and get him to the airport so he'd die in IBM's time.
Oh yeah, the insurance policy when you're traveling was like triple what it was otherwise, right? Yeah.
Did you know Stan Gebler?
I didn't. I heard the name, but I didn't really know him.
Stan was my IBM salesman for a while, and then when I was with Davidson. And we had IBM equipment, but we were putting in a message switch on a mini. We had taken over two computers that Alex Brown had, and we were putting in on a data general system. And it turned out Stan was the data general salesperson. So they were supposed to do some work for us and to get this message switch working. And I gave them an order. But I gave a contingency order on my saying that if that's contingent on them getting this switching application working. And they said, fine, no problem. And they delivered the data general. And, of course, the damn thing took a long time. It didn't work. So Stan is no longer with data general. So I wind up talking to Edison DeCastro, who was the founder and president of the firm. And he said, Wait a minute. We don't take contingency orders. I said, he took one this time. He said, no, we didn't. So I said, you better go check the order because I've got a copy right here signed by Stan. And they came back to the phone and they said, we'll make it work.
Wow.
They found it in Stan's desk, not attached to the official contract that was in the files.
Wow.
No wonder he left the farm.
Was right. They didn't take contingent orders except for this one.
All right. So what did you do at Martrek?
I went in to run their they never had a marketing and sales group, right? So I went in to get that started. So I hired some salespeople. In fact, Paul Savage from IBM and a bunch of other folks. And
Paul Savage was my salesperson at Morgan Stanley.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Good salesperson, right?
Yep.
He passed away, I want to say 2 years ago now. I actually hired him, and he got some of the things started. He actually wound up going back to IBM, actually, after Munchak Weber, but I was running sales and marketing, and then 9 months after I joined, Stu Munchak died. Stu, when I joined, I remember. Yeah, he was such a nice guy and such a good salesman, right? And he had multiple myeloma, my dad had the same thing, right? And he said, my doctor at Columbia Presbyterian is a leading expert on this. You know, why don't you have your dad's doctor talk to him? And they had a nice conversation. And, and I wound up finding out my treatment they were doing for my dad was exactly right, which is what I wanted to know. And it turns out my dad lived longer than Stu did. He died on New Year's Day, actually. And so what happened then was John Weber was the CEO, he and Stu were running it up till then. So I took over as chairman and, became like the chief operating officer. There was someone else working with me on it, but taking over all the sales and marketing and everything except the technology part of the company. And then we wound up selling it to Standard & Poor's, McGraw-Hill.
I thought you put a deal together with Merrill Lynch. You went with S&P?
I'm sorry. The Merrill Lynch deal was what was called Innet, right? It was a joint venture, and we had a deal going with them. ADP, what happened was Ritterizer, who was the guy at Merrill Lynch. We had gone around the IT guys at Merrill Lynch, and we were dealing with the, you know, Ritterizer, who was, you know, like the chief operating officer of the company. Ritterizer leaves to go to E.F. Hutton, and, you know, we were sort of out-positioned on the whole thing, and ADP saw what was happening, and ADP was going to lose their business to Internet, so ADP went to IBM and Merrill Lynch and said, we'll buy you out, and as long as Merrill Lynch signs a six-year contract with us, you know, we're going to give you this much money, and that's what happened. So that ended the MNET relationship on it. McGraw-Hill had purchased us because they knew about that deal, but we also had some good ticker stuff. But the guy who purchased this, actually, I don't think you know his name, Brent Harries.
I've heard it, but I didn't know him personally at all.
He was a good guy. He ran Blue Sheets, and he was up there. So anyway, he got pushed aside, and you know, so we had new management at S&P, and you know, the first meeting I have with the new management, you know, he says, "Tom, I got to tell you something. I was against this acquisition from the beginning," and I said, "Oh, it's nice meeting you also." You know, and from there it went downhill. So they bought us for $55 million, and then 3 or 4 years later, they sold us for $10 million. So it didn't work out that well for you know, for the McGraw-Hill Standard & Poor's people.
Right.
Go ahead. So then I eventually left there after that and joined Knight Ritter, which is the newspaper company headquartered out of Miami, and you know, they wanted to build a financial practice to, you know, contrast with what was happening, you know, with the newspaper business. And, you know, they were right about the newspaper business. I mean, it was just a declining time. I mean, I probably have my numbers wrong, but I think back then, you know, the amount of people that read a daily newspaper was, you know, like, you know, 65-70%, right? Now it's, I don't know, I don't even know if it's 30% now on it. So, you know, they saw what was happening with the newspaper business, and this was going to be the alternative to it. And, you know, we had some good success at it. It was really, you know, going up against Telerate at the time, and Reuters to some extent, but mostly Telerate. And then this company called Bloomberg, you know, we weren't even paying attention to, right? And they were just, you know, they were just on the side doing their stuff, and they came across and, you know, eventually, you know, passed Telerate, and now they compete against Thomson Reuters. It was a good experience. I mean, nice people. You know, we got into the commodities business. We bought a company called Commodity News Service, which got us into the commodities business, and you know, had a little bit of traction against Telerate, but we just weren't doing it as fast as the people in Miami needed it to get done, and so eventually sold out to what was Bridge at the time. So in retrospect, it's too bad that, you know, maybe it's partially my fault that I wasn't able to convince the guys down in Miami that, you know, hey, you know, we're like 2 years behind plan here, but you know, we'll be fine. But they really were at the point of, you have a plan, you haven't made the plan, so you know, let's wind up selling the business, which is too bad, you know. But now that business is really Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters, and I guess Interactive Data to some extent.
Didn't Knight Ritter have their own news terminals when they started that online news service? I believe I had one. I think I was a beta test for the news service.
Yeah, you know, it was probably Money Center. That's right.
Yeah.
It was probably Money Center, and we had a really good news organization, and we scooped Dow Jones, you know, every once in a while on it. The competitor was Dow Jones, right, on the news side, but they had a really good news organization, and that was the product, was the was the money center product. Because you need news to do these things, and we were focused on a fixed income market, and we had some really good reporters that were covering the mortgage-backed market and the corporate bond market, and you're right about that.
One of my close friends was the chief tax counsel for Merrill Lynch, and he said that he got into the middle of the negotiation with Bloomberg for Merrill putting in the Bloomberg terminals. And when I was with Bitsy, it was a big deal. The Quotron was the first to have that dual port system where they could use, and Bitsy was into that with them. And then Scantlin, and I remember Scantlin sold Jack Scantlin to Citibank. I remember they sold their own gym. My friend said that Michael Bloomberg is one of the smartest people that he ever met. You know, that he got to know him well during this negotiation, and he just said he was amazingly quick, and obviously he's proven that. So,
who's this guy Keith?
Who? Jack Scantlin, you mean?
No, the guy that did the negotiation at Merrill Lynch with Mike.
No, he was the chief chief tax attorney, a fellow named Jim Connor.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Oh, no, Mike was. I mean, you know, it's just, he just had a phenomenal, I don't know if you remember what he did. What he did was Merrill Lynch said, how much do you want for this? And he said, don't worry about it. You know, just start using it and then we'll figure it out, right? And then, I don't know if it was a year and a half, 2 years later, it was like they couldn't do it without it. You know, they had no other choice but
right.
to use it. And, he's just brilliant. I mean, he just, and he proved it over and over again. You know, I mean, he's back now running the company, right? He just came back, in the last 2 months. So, you know, we'll see what difference that makes, right? He did a great job as mayor of New York City. So he's a special kind of guy.
And the old WNEW is not just a good financial news radio station. It's a good pure news station that he has Bloomberg News, and of course now they have Business Week that was the McGraw Hill product. What led you to form your own firm?
1990 after Knight Ridder. What happened was. I was dealing with some guys at Drexel. I mean, the Knight Ridder thing was just like, you know, it just gets a little tiring, you know, when you start going through. I'd always worked for big companies, right? And you wind up going through budgets and then contingency planning and then relief and then you start all over again. And some of my friends at Drexel Burnham, they'd just gone bankrupt. And they said we'd really like to monetize some of the software because they had some really good software. You know, would you be interested in selling the software? And I said, sure. And by the way, I wasn't the only one that was selling it. George Davidson also got the rights to it,
right.
on it. But I think I was the only one successful at it and wound up. It was pretty cool because what you wind up doing is you wind up selling it and you keep 40% of what you sell. And I had space at Drexel Burnham, and, you know, so, you know, for the first couple of years, I had no overhead at all, right? You know, you just, working as a consultant for Drexel Burnham. I mean, the only downside was you couldn't hire anybody, right, because you were, you know, working over at the Drexel Burnham Trust. But it was a nice way to start the business. And, you know, it also was a little bit of a sabbatical because I'd always been, you know, ever since the U.S. Army, right, I always had this intense job. And I remember one day I was walking down 7th Avenue and I was in front of the Sheraton and it was 10 o'clock in the morning. And I just started laughing to myself. And, in New York City you can do that. I realized, I said, nobody cared where I was, you know. And it was like the first time in so long. And I said, this is sort of cool, you know, on it. But so that's why I started that. And then... I ran into somebody that said, gee, you look good. And I said, well, I didn't know I looked bad before, but, you know, I guess I bought the tension and stuff, but it was really good. So I don't know when we really got serious about doing something. It was probably like, you know, 4 or 5 years later that we wound up, you know, start doing, you know, consulting assignments and stuff on it. But it's the best way to start a business.
Drexel's communications manager, George Rohr, went over to work for Davidson. I don't know if you knew George. He was very close to Toot. Yeah, he was very close to Toot, too. Yeah, he had gone to the memorial service for Toot, and I couldn't go. I had something else to do. Toot died while I was in my second tour with Davidson, which was 20 years after my first tour. Rohr was there. You also mentioned Dave Lovell last night, who started with you. Dave had gone from, when White Well went away, he went to Blythe. And then when they went away, he was with Wagner Stott, and then George took over, who cleared through Merrill Lynch, and then George took over that clearance operation from Merrill. And that's probably when Dave went to work for you. I know that he wasn't happy about that Wagner Stott operation going away.
Yeah, I think that's right. And he wound up changing his career a little bit and wound up doing search for us, actually, not, you know, placing people. But he worked for me once before, by the way. He worked for Muncher Brother too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that after White Weld?
I'll tell you when it was, and you can tell me. It would have been in 83, 84.
That was after Blythe and possibly after Wagner Stott. I'm not sure. But no, probably not. Probably Munchak.
No, not after Wagner Stott, because you're right about Wagner Stott. I mean, his memory when he came to work for us was Wagner Stott, and yeah, he wasn't on that. And he married to Dawn Lowell, who was had quite a position at Lehman Brothers.
He asked me to go talk to her about doing some consulting years ago when I went down to Jersey City. I didn't meet with her. I met with someone else because she didn't want to meet with me because of my relationship with the husband. Now, he stayed home with the son, who I think needed some special care or something. But Dave was a very, very nice person.
And you know what the other thing, too, was? He knows back office, you know, and... He really knows how the whole security file. That's what he was doing for us at Munchak Weber, and he just knows how that how the whole back office stuff works. And so he was well respected at Munchak Weber.
But you're now in the 15th year of the firm's existence. How has the firm evolved over that time?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's finally together. You know, I mean, I guess people always feel that way, right? We started with, I guess management consulting on it. And we always had something to do with the market data business because of my experience at Knight Ridder and also at Munchak Weber. So we now have three practices. One is the management consulting, which has really turned into compliance because compliance is just so hot right now. That's where I'm running a panel on Thursday night, and I don't know the answer to the question, but the question is, and you know, it's for three of the top people, firms on the street. You know, what percent of your new development budget is for compliance and regulatory? You know, forget about all the maintenance stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the answer, I'll find out, I can tell you on Friday morning or Thursday night, I think the answer is probably going to be above 50%. You know, it's going to be where it is. So that's where we're really putting our focus now, is on the compliance end of the business. And, you know, we've developed a nice product that, if people, you know, we take the firm's trades and we tell them whether they're in compliance with, you know, some of the rules that, the SEC has, and the rules keep on changing. So that's that one practice. And the second one is the market data one. We're like probably the most significant player in that marketplace. And, you know, we help people manage their market data. You know, these big firms, like you were talking about Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, firms like that, they'll probably spend, you know, $500-600 million a year on market data. And so we help the firms stay in, you know, make sure they use that money effectively and stay in compliance with all the rules, because the rules are, you know, get pretty complicated. You know, you might be taking information from 150 or 200 different vendors or exchanges, and so we specialize in that. And then the third thing is we have industry solutions, and this is where, you know, we bring people together to collaborate, and it's a group called the Financial Information Forum, you know, which we actually own, and that one there is broker-dealers and exchanges and vendors, and they work on a lot of any big initiative that's coming up. The second one is the FIX protocol, which is the way people trade on Wall Street, and it's all volunteer stuff, it's all open source stuff, but with a paid resource, making sure that works. And then we have something called RixML, which is on the research side of it. So the only consistency is that it's all securities industry and it's all technology, but I just think that you know, as we look into 2015, you know, we're probably, you know, we're feeling pretty good about where we are right now.
It's interesting you mentioned the focus on compliance, because the public, or at least the non-investing public, grew very suspicious of Wall Street because of the various scandals involving fraud with the mortgage bust and money laundering and the compensation of executives after the bailout. Do you think the financial community has won back the confidence of the American people?
No, and I think we just have to do I think we have to do a better job of it. You know, we this you know, we have to do a better job of explaining the story, right, on the whole thing, right? I mean, John, when you and I started, right, I mean, that's a long time ago, right? But, you know, you had fixed commissions, and, of course, you don't have that anymore now, right? But, you know, from an individual investor point of view, right, the market data, if you do enough trading with Schwab or Interactive Brokers or Fidelity or TD Ameritrade, right, you don't even pay for the market data, right? And so I can pay, you know, $9.95 for a trade and get a confirmation back within a second or two, right? Now, that's pretty good. And there's no country in the world that comes even close to that, right? And so I think we got to do a better job of explaining the benefits of it. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, there are some bad areas. And, you know, the high-frequency trading one is the more difficult one to explain. But I think that could even be explained, that there's, you know, some benefits of that. And there are some bad guys on the whole thing. I mean, you know, you do have the, you know, the situations like the Madoffs and some of the others that that happen on it. But I think we just got to do a better job of explaining what it is and, you know, to the individual investor. Because I think you're right. They don't, you know, they don't have the faith of the whole thing. Well, the other part about it, too, John, is that, you know, you talk about the managed money, right? And, you know, even the hedge fund business on things, right? And, you know, sometimes it's just safer to just do an index fund on the whole thing. And it's cheaper, and some of the index funds will beat the majority of the hedge funds. But one of the things we're going to talk about on Thursday night is, and we got all these new regulations, and one of the other questions we had a prep call last week, is are we in better shape now because of all of these new regulations as an industry? And I think the answer is probably yes, but there are some areas in which we're, you know, spending a lot of money for, you know, no benefit, and I think we got to do a better job of explaining that to the regulators or to the legislators.
Well, there's always been pushback on new regulations. I remember when 15C3 went in, everyone kept saying, how can you do this? And you got to control this, you got to control that. And that turned out to be no problem at all, you know. But there was this big pushback about, oh, it's going to change everything in the cage. Well, it didn't, you know. And now, talking about how the industry's changed, I mean, when you and I started on the street, who would ever thought that Merrill Lynch would have fallen apart in the Don Reagan days and then being taken over by Bank America that really saved the firm? I mean, Merrill Lynch was the brokerage firm that the whole world knew about, you know. And then I was with both Dean Wood and Morgan Stanley. And now I only have to go to one alumni party, you know, since they went together, you know. And the mystery. Go ahead.
I think you're right. I mean, you know, like on the, you know, the Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I mean, a lot of the Merrill Lynch guys still, you know, run, you know, some of the areas that I deal with, you know, the trading end of it and things like that. And they, you know, I mean, these people just got caught up in these mortgage-backed deals and these over-the-counter derivative things. And it just, you know, if it weren't for Bank of America, right, they'd be out of it. I mean, you know, I mean, I always thought Bear Stearns was a pretty cool operation, to tell you the truth, right?
Sure.
And, you know, on it. And so, yeah, you wouldn't have guessed. I mean, even your old company, Morgan Stanley, I mean, this guy's done a great job in bringing them back, right? But it wasn't that obvious, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago that they were going to make it. But they're back to where they were. And by the way, the Dean Witter part of them has really helped, you know, the retail side of the business.
And First Boston got gobbled up in Credit Suisse. And what was the fella's name? There were two ops managers at Bear Stearns. We did business with them, and they were they in the other house that was big. I did some consulting there when a guy named Bob Ginsburg was at Bear Stearns, and it was another big heavy guy. Had been there for a long time, very nice guy. Oh
yeah,
and talking about public confidence, I mean, when Goldman got caught selling securities, pushing securities at clients that they wouldn't touch themselves, that were on the other side of their, you know, their. That was why that all of these people want to go back to Sarbanes-Oxley. And I don't know whether that's going to ever happen, but yeah, but not Sarbanes-Oxley. What was the?
That's Sarbanes-Oxley. Yeah,
Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall. Yeah. Yeah, it's not going to happen. You know, I mean, it's not going to happen, right? On the whole thing, and we just talked about it. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch wouldn't have survived if it weren't for the bank side of it. The Bank of America,
right?
You know, side of the whole thing. So,
Glass-Steagall was directly responsible for the formation of both Morgan Stanley and First Boston. First Boston was the trading arm of the Bank of Boston, and Morgan Stanley was part of J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan's grandson, Charlie Morgan, was one of the nicest guys in the world. He worked at Morgan Stanley when I was there. Very nice person. They let him do his own thing. He was much more interested in laying out new buildings and new office space than doing anything with securities. Whenever you'd need a phone call made to some other firm, you'd go see Charlie, and Charlie knew the right people, you know.
Wow.
So who's the other Jordan?
Well, it was going to be my daughter, but, you know, what happened was she went into investment banking, and then we couldn't afford her anymore. So there isn't all the Jordan right now. She went to work for Salomon Brothers, and then she went to private equity, and she actually has three kids now. So she actually works for us now, like, you know, one day a week. You know, she's doing, you know, financial stuff, financial analysis type work for us. So she works there. My wife works there also, but you know, we haven't officially said who the other Jordan is, so it's right now it's just it's me right now.
Salomon was the other big firm that just disappeared into the network,
right?
World.
Yeah, and
with
Citibank,
yeah,
and yeah. Into Citi, right? And
right.
But you know, remnants of that exist, and you'd be surprised how many. Well, maybe you wouldn't be surprised how many you know, cliques of people who worked together, who were really proud of what they did, wound up, you know, working together again. And Solomon's in that category. DLJ's in that DLJ's in that category. You know, the people who worked together and they had really, a pretty good run, and they wind up, bringing them back together again.
Yes, the Sandy Wiles deal was to put everything together. He was really one of the first bank people to want the insurance company and the brokerage firm and everything all together. I remember when people first suggested insurance companies merging. I remember brokers saying, "What are you crazy? I go up to a party and people want to talk to me. Everyone wants to talk about the market." They say people run from insurance guys because they always think they're trying to sell them insurance. So they didn't want any part of that in the old days, you know. So.
Well, there's really no synergy between insurance and banking and securities. I mean, they talk about it, but it's like, as I said, my first job was insurance, right, on the whole thing. But there's nothing. I mean, we meet with firms all the time that, you know, want to get into, big companies, right, and they want to get into the financial markets, right. And they'll say, we're really big in the financial markets. You know, we're doing a couple hundred million dollars in business. I said, I've never heard of you in the financial markets. They said, oh, we mean insurance, right? It's just different. There's no consistency. I mean, yeah, only consistency.
Yeah, but Prudential bought Beige and Sandy Wild bought Travelers for Citicorp. So they, you know,
yeah,
they've tried.
Yeah, they bought them. They bought them, but then they wound up, Prudential and Beige, they never really integrated anything together. It's just different. A securities firm is the only consistency is on the asset management side of the business, right, which is not what you and I know, but it's the investment side of the business. So Prudential has all these pension funds that they manage, right, and Beige, you know, might manage some money and things like that. But Prudential exists now, but Beige is over at Jefferies, a brokerage firm.
Right.
On that, and Sandy Weill, you know, I think he used it sort of as a platform to get back into the financial markets again. But the synergy between banking and securities, but even banking, John. I mean, I really think we know more about the securities industry than most firms do. But we know nothing about retail banking. You know, we just don't. It's just a different, life cycle, altogether. Like even the regulations are different. You know, on the whole thing. Now, by the way, they're getting caught up in it because some of the securities firms have become banks. And the reason why they became banks was so that they can get money at the Fed window, and
right.
When they do that, now they're liable to some regulations of banks, and like there's the Office of Control of the Currency, which they never had to do before, and so they'll get some of those regulations, and some of them are consistent because a lot of them have to do with making sure your vendor's doing the right kind of job and things like that. But in terms of processing on it. There's just not much overlap that I see.
I remember years ago, and this is going back another 35 years, when banks they were allowed, and this was a big deal because we installed it. That Bankers Trust, Dan McClune sold the business for Bitsy, and at Bankers Trust. We took them in to filing by security. They always had to file this stuff by account, and they called it FOSB. It was a big deal because then they could lend securities if they could find the securities and all this stuff. And we put a big system in. A fellow named Harold Fliega was the who had previously been with some firms and Phil Dinelli. They were the Bankers Trust guys. So the regulations had to be, once again, regulations had to be changed. One thing that I learned there was the auditors were much more important in banks, in brokerage firms, up until firms got into trouble. They could kind of tell their internal auditors, come back later. But these guys had to approve everything. And talking to one of the auditors, they read the regulations and the contracts, anything that they put out, they read backwards. Really, literally backwards. Looking at
words. I think you're right, John. I think you're right now. I think the securities internal auditors are getting that kind of power now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for the first time.
They didn't have the when I started on the street, boy. I remember the guy named Paul Bigelow, whose family was Paul Upton Bigelow. His family was related to both Harris Upton and Bigelow T. And his father was the chess columnist for New York Post. He was hired out of the exchange, or got a house and sold the bill of goods. He was going to be the internal auditor, and he showed up in the cage. He wanted to freeze all deliveries in the E's to the H's, and he said, "Who are you?" You know, so he went into the cashier, and he came back and said, "What are you doing? This is we're doing business." And the guy said, "Well, you saw the internal laws. I'm freezing these for accounties. I don't care who you are. Get out of my cage." That was the end of that one. So we've covered a lot of grounds tonight. Is there anything else you'd like the audience to know about Thomas Jordan?
No, I don't think so. I think you did a good job of going through it. I mean, I think the big deal is, it's an exciting, business to be in, and you just have to keep learning. I mean, we talked about it at the beginning about the ethics of the hard work of, going to Raleigh or whatever and working around and stuff like that. The business has changed a little bit in that, and maybe for the better, right? In terms of the work-life balance is, I think, probably a little more mature. But the difference, the thing that hasn't changed is the need to keep learning. And when we talk to young people that were hiring, I mean, I just tell them that I just keep learning. Every week on the new items that are going on. And the beauty of the market now, John, is that there's a lot you have to learn. It's easy to learn if you want to learn it, right? Because you have all these electronic access to information. But it's the focus and the desire to drill down and to talk to people and learn more about it. I mean, remember at IBM, one of my managers, the big fear we always had at IBM was your manager would say, "Where do you want to be in 5 years, right?" And, I never knew where I was going to be in 5 years, right? And I said, "I just want to do the best job that I'm doing now, right?" And then that would, lead to the next move. And I said, "Where do you want to be in 5 years?" He goes, "I think I got the same answer, to that, So, but, I mean, the great thing about it now is that there's just, I tell you, if I was starting over again, I'd still go in the securities industry, combination of technology, securities industry and technology. I was at a cocktail party last night at a big hedge fund manager, and I met some guy that I hadn't met before. He worked for Google, and, he works for Google in California, and he's thinking about making a change, he's pretty cool on security, right? And he said, "I know a bunch of people. What do you think about it?" I said, "All I know is the financial markets, right? And there's just so much that can be done on security and the financial markets. If you got an interest in it and you have some people, we should talk and we'll, educate you a little bit on the markets." But it's just a great time. It's a great time to be in the industry, the securities industry, a great time to, have access to technology and learn more about technology. So that's a long answer to a short question, I guess.
You have to really be into it, though. I remember when I was with Bitsy, and we used to, most firms do one major installation every 18 months, say. I'd do 8 of them a year because we constantly bring clients onto the system, either in their in their place, like Morgan Stanley, or in the Service Bureau basis, Weiss, Peck and Greer, Dominic and Dominic, a whole bunch of firms. I used to tell people when I'd hire them, and I hired the former cashier for I was in Hanley Artie Foote, and I hired former cashier from someplace else, and Dominic, that I can't pay you enough if you don't really like this stuff, because it's going to be 3 o'clock some Sunday morning. You're going to be in a computer room, and you're going to say, "What the hell am I doing here?" If you really don't like what you're doing, you know, and you're going to work 8 weekends a year, with parallel testing, you're probably going to work 20 weekends a year. You really have to like what you're doing, and a lot of people don't realize that to be good at something, that you have to have both a passion and be willing to put the time in, you know? So.
Yeah.
We began speaking to one mutual friend. I'm going to close on another. George Davison was a co-worker at Dean Witter & Company, and he founded two Wall Street technology consulting firms, Davison Computer Service and George Davison and Son, both of which I was an employee 20 years apart. Although George never fulfilled his childhood desire to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers, he realized the large majority of his goals in the Brooklyn industry, bringing innovations throughout his entire career. I used to tell people that while 50% of what George says sounds like science fiction, only 10% of it is, the rest will come true. And I was right, as was George. We fell out of touch when I returned to the academic world in the 1990s, and I was greatly saddened when his son Joseph, now the CEO of the firm, told me recently that George had a massive stroke 2.5 years ago and is unable to communicate. Now, and think about this, if George still has the speculative mind that he had, and I don't know that he does, but if he can't communicate, that would be a living hell, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Did you know George, Walter?
I did. I knew George well, and his margin systems are still installed at some of the firms. He just was the passion of the company. That's a funny story. I got a phone call. It was a while ago now. And it was a company that wanted to acquire a company that was in the back office business. And I said, "Well, you know, we do back office consulting, but we're not in the back office business." He said, "Well, we want to acquire somebody. Could you recommend someone?" I said, "You bet, George Davison and Company. These guys are terrific, right, on it." And so I gave him his phone number, and I called George, and the guy calls me back, and he said, "George, you know, he won't give us, he just tells us how much money he wants for the company. He won't show us the books, right?" So I called George up. I said, "George, you know, these guys are really interested. You know, if you're interested, you know, show me books." He said, "I don't trust these guys." I said, "George, nobody's going to buy the company, you know, without showing the books, right?" I don't think he really wanted to sell it, you know what I mean? He's one of these guys that loved what he was doing, and you know, whatever price he had was always above what anyone would be willing to pay. But he was just and I went to a lot of his events. I mean, you know, he, you know, at these SIA shows, you know, which is a shadow of his former self now. But right. He always had the best events. It was probably because of Joseph, right? But it didn't matter. People would always look forward to it. So he was just a real pioneer in the industry, and a very decent guy.
He was a very decent guy, but when he started the business, he had already done volunteer. He's responsible for the Hasidics getting into Wall Street and getting into things other than jewelry business, because he used to teach classes at the yeshivas in Kobol and other things while he was at Dean Witter. So then he formed his own company. He would hire them. And when I got there, I was amazed. I said, "Who's that guy? I haven't seen him before." And they said, he's a trainee. And what George would do, he'd bring them in like they were trying out for New York Yankees. And they'd work there for 2 weeks for no pay, and they either made the cut or they didn't. And before I had gotten there, there was a fellow who was his project manager at when they were putting in the system for Shields, putting in the Martin system. And the guy came to George to give notice. And George said, "You can't give notice. I need you on this account. It's not going to happen if you don't stay." And he says, "Well, I've got a family and I can't, George." And he said, "I've got the right to leave." And George said, "We'll see about that." And George hired him. George hauled him up before a rabbinical court. And they listened to both stories. And they told this guy, "He's right. You get back to Davis."
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. The guy had to finish the installation at Shields.
Oh, my God.
Different world.
Oh, my God.
That's funny. I'm meeting with a guy from Shields in a couple of weeks, a guy that used to work at A.G. Becker, Jack Kennedy. I'll see if he remembers the story.
Yeah, this was years and years before they were sold to Beige. Well, thank you very much.
George is a very religious guy. I remember one of my friends, who's also a good customer of George and loves George, told him that his son was getting married, and he said, "Oh, good, you know." But it turns out he was marrying a Christian, and he said, "Oh, I feel so sorry for you," and you know, it's like, you know. And this guy was not as serious about, you know, he was not as orthodox as George was. He goes, "That's all right,
Two stories like that. Ben Lubin was the managing partner that runs Nordeman, and his secretary was Harriet McNeil, and her main name was some Jewish name. When the word got out that she was going to marry this redheaded guy named McNeil, George sincerely tried to talk her out of it because she probably couldn't bring her children up if she had any as Jewish. And then I was at Joe Davison's, both his bris and his wedding. And his wedding was at the Marina del Rey over on the under the Throgneck Bridge. And there was easily 1,500 people at the wedding. They used the chapel there, and one of the cantors was the fellow who, what was the guy's name? He campaigned for Rudy Giuliani, then they got in trouble because he made some impolitic remarks. He's a comedian, but he was also a cantor, and it was, I've never been at anything like it. The food and everything was out of this world, and the Hasidic men had a separate room. The Hasidic women, they could mingle with the other guests, or they could sit by themselves. It was that they weren't worried about them getting in trouble, but they were worried about the men getting in trouble. That seemed to be how it worked, but it was a wonderful event. Yes, George was very religious, and he became more religious as he got older, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Thomas. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been great talking to you, John. We'll have to keep in touch. I really enjoyed this.
Okay. A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, historian Daniel Pipes, and Professor Oren Levin-Wallman. The Westchester Guardian is available in print and online at westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at open.salon.com/blog/johnmack13. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Met win, and there wasn't too many of this shit, put it in a book. Go to my website of johnmack13.com for URLs to previous shows, to schedule to upcoming shows. Turn in next week to hear my conversation with Renee L.K. Esterbrook. Whoa, so steady, big fella, steady.